question of Shandy, and he's going to talk about Kakastan and Robin Sheet. So, Jeremy.
The correct pronunciation is Kasputa. but that's okay. You're in among the majority.
It's my French accent.
Yeah, you're right. It's actually Kasputan is Kuskustan is a delicacy. Tuna and couscous. But thank you very much, everybody, for coming. And thanks. I would like to thank the organizers. It was a wonderful trip from my home institute to here, which is just across the aisle. So I'm gonna tell you about connections with, I think, a handful of very interesting and fascinating connections to me that this, I think, has been made over the past few years between completely different theories that it seems that they are actually now related for very interesting reasons. And it may not seem that way, but probably I'm among people here, I'm the most excited about this Mujawal Lipschitz, although I may sound skeptical, but I'm really excited about all these possibilities, and I hope to convey some of this excitement to you over the next hour. So I'm going to start with an introduction. I'm going to tell you about the relationship between low energy, Mujawal Lipschitz, and Kasputan. And I just noticed this morning that the title of this workshop is Gravity at the Lipschitz Point, but I'm going to talk about gravity away from the Lipschitz Point. So it may not be the perfect match, but anyway. And then, of course, for most of you, I'm going to then answer what is Kasputan. And then finally, I'm going to talk about relations, which relation to black holes, dark energy, and the cosmological constant problem. This, as a cosmologist, this is my own background, the most exciting possibility. And I've written some references in red, and most of the papers you can find by some permutations of these authors. But let's start with an introduction. And so, of course, we are all here because quantum gravity is such a challenging and, at the same time, fascinating problem. Now, as a cosmologist, I can tell you my take on it. So a cosmologist quantum gravity problem. And I think I can say maybe we as cosmologists, we are probably the most affected by the consequences of the problem. So we are probably the most dependent on you guys for solving this. So the most fundamental problem is, of course, the denormalizability, which is the most challenging from the theoretical point of view. Or maybe, who knows. And that, of course, is ultimately intimately related to the singularity problem in cosmology and astrophysics. Then there is the cosmological constant problem. And please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point. And this is, of course, most crucial, even though it may not sound as intellectually challenging as denormalizability. This is the most crucial one for cosmologists because, of course, the name is on it. And then there is a dark energy problem, which is that's also intimately related to the cosmological constant problem. Dark energy problem and its coincidence with a structure formation. And so people don't usually put these in the same category as quantum gravity, but the fact is that all of these arise when you put quantum mechanics and gravity on the same footing. And hopefully a full theory of quantum gravity is going to address all these questions, and all of these are crucial importance for cosmological observations. Now, there are three solutions well, I mean, probably many more, but at least from, again, a cosmologist point of view, there are three solutions which we have heard most of them over the past few days. The first one is there are new degrees of freedom. So general relativity is not the whole world. And of course, this is, in a sense, it's the most conservative solution because we know there are other things in the world. And a string theory, in a sense, does this to the maximal degree by introducing new dimensions and all sorts of new things, say string theory. Well, that's a question. That's
the crucial question. Are they all heavy or not? Yeah, of course, we haven't seen any other light degree of freedom, but there could be more. And then it is that question, why don't we see any other light degree of freedom? But I guess that's more of a model building question than a fundamental question. The other approach is maybe just we're not smart enough. General relativity is the full theory of everything, or plus a standard model, maybe.
And this asymptotic safety. Is the answer? Of course, I always heard, and I'm by no means I'm an expert in this, but then I keep hearing this word ghost being thrown around, and some people say it's not a problem, but most people I talk to, until at least last few days, say that it might be a problem if you want to have a higher curvature terms. So I leave that discussion to the experts. Now, the last possibility, which is, of course, the subject of this workshop, and it's most down-to-earth possibility from my point of view, which is, again, the cosmologist's point of view, is breaking Lorentz invariants. Break Lorentz symmetry. Now, that is, by most theoretical physicists' standards, this is a very theoretical statement that we developed the past 100 years, basically working and holding via the Lorentz symmetry as a fundamental, or the covariance as a fundamental principle for everything. And then you want to decide to break it at the last minute because you cannot solve the problem. So that might be, some people may find it as a way of getting out of the problem, which is fine. As a cosmologist, though, we never really had Lorentz symmetry. So cosmologists are used to FRW metrics, not Minkowski metrics, and they maximally break Lorentz symmetry. If you look at our universe, cosmic microwave background, for example, is homogeneous to 1 part in 10 to the 5 on a spatial hypersurfaces, but changes by order 1 as you move by Hubble time. So the cosmology is very much not Lorentz invariant. So that sounds like the most natural possibility, that why should the fundamental physics be Lorentz invariant? And at some level, you should break Lorentz invariants. Exactly where you do it, of course, is the question. Yes?
Breaks Lorentz invariants because the solution breaks Lorentz invariants.
That's correct.
It's different from having a fundamental theory which creates.
Well, so that's the thing. So that people often make this distinction that one is spontaneous, the other is fundamental. But of course, when you go to the early universe, then you really mix the blur the boundary of these two, I think, that it's not obvious whether you can. Well, so let's say, I think it seems that you have to break Lorentz invariant somehow in the very early universe. That's how you pick a preferred frame. Now, you might break it as spontaneously, but it's still a break. So, but then I think it certainly seems that our universe today has this symmetry. But the initial conditions doesn't seem to have a symmetry. Whether it's because the UV complete theory doesn't have the symmetry, or something probabilistic happened in the early universe, that's not obvious. But again, I would say, now, there are other cosmologists in the room, but I would say this is a cosmologist's favorite. Favorites. Now, of course, this a cosmologist's favorite, so that would be me, or just general. Yes.
What you're saying is that we usually use FRW as the cosmology model, standard model.
Yeah.
That has a symmetry R cross all three.
Yes.
So, which is breaking the SL3
convention. That's right, exactly.
However, it just has symmetrically symmetric solution. Possible that there are other cosmological models.
Yeah.
Which
definitely
affect them. Still be homogeneous at the surface of large catchment. Such models exist. So.
But you agree that you should break the symmetry between the Lorentz symmetry you work at, don't you?
Yeah, well, the problem is that there's no laboratory or accelerator experiment that detects breaking the Lorentz symmetry.
Well, okay, so that's the point I mentioned, that you spontaneously break it. So I'm not making any controversial point.
Lorentz covariance, you break general covariance?
That's a bit more subtle, because general covariance, you can always make that a covariant object. The same way that you made ether a covariant object. So general covariance is a bit different from Lorentz covariance, but I think all audience here, the difference is clear, so I don't want to argue too much on terminology. Now, one thing not everybody in this room may know about is actually the history of this object. And I just want to make two historical points, two historical notes. One is...
historical and historical notes. And there are... now, of course, that's whether it's historical or not, it's up to the audience. First is the last time where the symmetry, which was fundamental, broken. And that was when Einstein's gravity was introduced. So we used to have a symmetry in the 19th century, which was, and this is just an example, but it's an interesting example, I think. We used to have a symmetry which made orbits close in the solar system. So for Keplerian potential, or Newtonian potential, whatever you want to call it, for one of our potentials, this leads to omega r equal to omega phi, which meant you had closed orbit. Now, this is not at the same level as the symmetries that we talk about today, but you can imagine a philosopher in the 19th century would say that any theory of gravity would need to keep orbits closed, because, why? It sounds like a fine tuning that you make a potential exactly make these two equal. And it does sound like a fine tuning.
Exactly.
Special,
right? But why a 1 over r? So isn't it fine tuning to have a 1 over r potential? So maybe then that philosopher would include that there is a symmetry of nature that makes these two the same, so you always have closed orbits. So you can always have 1 over r potential. But of course, Einstein's gravity broke that symmetry. And that led to, perihelion precession that was confirmed observationally. So this has happened before in physics, that you have symmetries that look exact, but then they're broken. And who knows?
What would you call that, if you make multiple moments of bodies that would also break 1 over r potential, would be also breaking?
But then again, there's always spontaneous breaking and then fundamental breaking. That would be a spontaneous breaking in the sense you're building the point particles, but the collection of point particles. But that's a different one. So, but a statement left, again, that's a philosophical issue. But let's say somebody says it's symmetry that. For any theory of gravity that you choose, the two-body problem must have closed orbits. And the two-body problem is for two-point objects. And that would only pick 1 over r, and there are some extra conditions. But anyway, so my point is that this has happened before. And you can imagine things like these symmetries that are apparent are broken when you go to a more fundamental theory.
So there's maybe global symmetries? Local symmetries.
Well, I think the general principle is the same. This is of course very different. I'm not talking about a fifth theory here. I'm talking about just three-dimensional problem. But my point again is the same, that you could have accidental symmetries in a low energy theory that are emergent from a more fundamental theory, and that's the point that many people seem to seem to be really useless or talk about. I mean, not, that may not be the case for Lorentz symmetry, but that's certainly a possibility.
You cannot do it for local symmetries. You cannot go and have this without a strongly coupled dynamics.
That you have sure, to... but I'm fine with a strongly coupled dynamics. So. So the next point is actually a gravitational ether, or ether, which is not, you would think it's a new concept, but of course, ethers have been around. They are older than Einstein relativity. And for example, Riemann, the famous Riemann, had a paper in 1853 where he proposed that the gravity is mediated by an incompressible gravitational ether. And of course, so before Einstein, there were lots of gravitational ether theories because people thought that how could objects that are at such large distances interact with each other? So they proposed all these medium or the ether medium that propagated forces through either pressure or vorticity or some physical process. Now, particularly Riemann had this idea that this must be incompressible because he was worried about energy conservation issues. And what I'm going to argue is that all these things that we're talking about these days, they are actually an incompressible gravitational ether. Exactly. And the definition of incompressible is when a speed of sound is infinite. So that's another. So maybe there are no real new ideas under the sun. And Riemann might have already had the idea. Of course, not such detail that we do right now. So that's the introduction. So now let's get down to the calculations.
I mean,
of course, the old theory, the ether theory, at least the traditional one, was ruled out. But then, I'm not saying that a theory of gravity is not a geometrical theory. Of course, you need to add the geometry. And it turns out that at low energies, you don't see ether, maybe, for some reason. So I don't know. I'm not saying anything radical. I'm just rephrasing everything that people have said today and yesterday and throughout the workshop, that you might have this ether, this preferred frame, but you don't couple to it at low energies. You need to go to very high energies to couple to this preferred frame. So microcellularly, as long as photons don't have large enough energy, then you don't really see the preferred frame effect. You see what I'm saying?
It seems to me in physics today we don't pay enough attention to experiments.
I'm a cosmologist, you cannot tell me that. I'm probably the only one here who's worked with real data. But no, I didn't mean to offend anyone. But I actually that's the most important thing. Data is my primary concern. So let's start with Petr's proposal for modifications of Einstein gravity, and let's keep the low energy terms, which seems to be the most controversial over the past few months.
The formulation that I had read, and it's not might not be exactly the same. Of my unit, this is how it looks like. And then plus higher order curvature terms, say order r squared. But at low energies, this classically it seems that this is the only thing that's left of the theory. Now, of course, this part is foliation invariance. This is the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action. This is the part that breaks foliation or refoliation symmetry. Now, people talk about this as this is, again, a heretical or bizarre thing, but this is just a scalar tensor theory, because whenever you break Lorentz symmetry, whenever you introduce a covariant a preferred frame, then that preferred frame or that preferred foliation introduces a scalar for you. So you always can come up with a covariant formulation, and the time in the preferred frame is that the scalar field that you have. So this is, of course, something that we've been talking about as scalar tensor theories for the past 50 years or so. So you would think that by now we must have some experience with the types of the scalar tensor theories that can arise. And but usually when people talk about a scalar tensor theory, they talk about ones with covariant kinetic terms, or sorry, with canonical kinetic terms, thank you, as well. But of course, that doesn't need to be the case. For example, you could have things like DBI action, where the kinetic term is not canonical. But in general, any theory that breaks Lorentz invariant or introduces a preferred frame is a scalar tensor theory. Then the only challenge is to write down the theory in terms of the scalar and the metric. And I'm going to show you that it's going to actually look very simple in this case. So.
No.
Then
in general.
I was showing a new term that you have to consider.
I don't have to consider, sorry?
You have to consider a new term in the infrared, this alpha term I mentioned before.
Well, do you think I. So, you said potato.
I mean, you said it was the most general thing, you know what?
Yeah, I didn't say it's the most general thing. I said in general these are scalar tensor theories, but no, this is not the most general thing. This is just the proposal that Peter had. And you could share, of course, yours is most general thing, you have to add your thing. And an argument theory, that's the most general thing, because you can write, I mean, you know, scalar tensor theories.
If you consider this transformation of the scalar, that must
be
informed.
But my point is, the scalar tensor theories are actually much more general. You could have any function of phi and d mu phi.
You can. If you assume a reparametrization invariance on the
scalar.
Okay,
so that's I'm not assuming. And that we can argue about. Actually, if there's reparametization invariance, I'm not something I'm. I don't think that's crucial to the theory, but
it is. Otherwise, you cannot have many things, as you say.
Yeah.
It's like having the t going to n of t in the.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you could add other kinetic.
Okay, so let's argue about that. But I'm going to argue about that later, maybe in a few minutes. But my point is that you have generally a scalar tensor theory can be very general. Yes.
I want to make a very general statement that take any action and introduce the vacuum expectation value of a vector field, the gradient of a scalar, non-zero, you violate the Lorentz invariant.
Yeah, sure.
Completely general statement.
Sure, sure.
So you can do it in string theory, whatever you want. But
yeah.
It's effectively what you're saying.
Yeah, I am. That's what I'm saying here. So the scalar tensor theories are not as theoretical as great Lorentz invariants, but they are really just saying.
Question.
Yes.
Another question: whether or not the orthogonal theory that was mentioned yesterday would fit into this framework, because it also puts in a foliation. Arguably, the Lagrangian is kind of sick and doesn't really work too well. But at the formal level, it happens when you throw away the scalar, spatial scalar curvature.
Yeah, orthogonal theory. You mean the projectable theory?
No, this is just starting with the conventional GR.
Uh-huh.
Imagine rewriting it in the AVM variables.
Yes.
And in the spatial part of the Hamiltonian, you have the spatial curvature. Throw that away, and you get the so-called auto.
Ah, yeah.
And it's interesting that of course, picks out a preferred foliation, but it has the same number of local gauge symmetries as GR. So at the formal level, the counting of degrees of freedom would be, again, no scale degree of freedom.
Maybe, yeah. I think that's I never thought about it, but that was the first time I heard about that theory. So maybe we should think about, or should talk about that. But let me actually actually explicitly show you why this is write down this is the Lagrangian, and this is actually a very simple derivation. So the only part that really I think is that is that breaks foliation symmetry. So the only part that the scalar can depend on, but the only part where the scalar does appear is this part, and I'm doing it at low energy, so I'm ignoring this part. So I just want to look at this term.
integral d4x square root of minus gk squared. And let me remind you that k is grad mu u mu. K is a trace of the extrinsic curvature, which is grad mu u mu, where u mu is the normal, unit normal, to constant time surfaces. So let me just erase this. So u mu is, say, d mu psi divided by a square root of, say, d alpha psi, where alpha is the time in the prepared frame. So let's call it Tojava's time. So if it doesn't mind. Sorry?
Psi, yes, psi. So you first, now I have a covariance theory, but then if you go into the preferred frame, then your time becomes psi.
So this is, again, non-controversial. Now, but the interesting thing is how I can write down this term. So this term is now integral d4x, a square root of minus g, grad mu, and then u mu, which is that.
Once you find the equation of motion, you fix the...
Psi is dynamical. This characterizes my preferred focus. Constant psi surfaces are the preferred focus. Okay. Now, let me add the square root of this, of course.
Now, what I can do is I can just, so this is an exact equality, but at the classical level, it's exact. I introduce a dynamical field phi, which is minus is 2 phi d mu u mu minus pi squared. Okay. So this is not, let's just write this the original form. It's just grad mu u mu squared. So what I've done is I just introduced this non-dynamical variable. So it's not quite a Lagrange multiplier because it's not linear in phi. But if you minimize the action in terms of phi, then you get phi is d vu, and then you plug that back in here, you get the original. Right? Okay. Now I can do an integration by part, put the grad on phi. So what I get is minus 2 grad mu phi u mu. So now I have a Lagrangian, or an action which has only first derivatives. Now it had second derivatives of psi, because this is one derivative and there's another derivative. But now that I introduce this auxiliary variable phi, they only have first derivatives. And the action looks like minus 2 d mu phi d mu psi over a square root of d alpha psi. Minus phi squared. Okay? So all I've done is just to introduce this new auxiliary variable and write things in terms of these two variables. Psi was the Hojava's time, and phi on shell is just the extrinsic curvature, really. So this phi is the same as k, really. Now, it looks kind of bizarre, which it means it's actually reminiscent of the kind of thing that Paul showed yesterday, that you have first derivatives in your kinetic term, not second derivatives. At least for phi, that's the case. Now, let me vary this with respect to psi and show you the equation of motion. The equation that I get is interesting. And this is actually what you saw during the last talk as well. I quite as horizon. That I think this looks fine. Okay, so this FI just, it's not hard to do it. You can just vary this with respect to psi and get an equation of motion. The interesting thing, though, is that, and this is exactly the same as the secondary constraint that Diego was talking about. Because you see, this is the gradient of, but this is the covariant formulation of that. This is essentially the gradient of phi, this is the extrinsic curvature. And this is some number, it depends on the lapse. And this is the projection vector, so this is really just a spatial gradient. So if you go to the preferred frame, this essentially, this is just grad I, some mij, grad j, k, or phi, let's say, equal to zero. Now, I'm claiming that the only solution to this is phi constant. And there are different ways of saying this, but this is essentially the uniqueness theorem for Laplace equation, which you can say that this is the solution to, so let me go up here. If you define, say, an energy, which is, say, integral d3x, mij, grad I, phi, grad j, phi, equal to zero. This, let's say this, if you minimize this energy, you get this equation. And if mij is positive definite, which it is actually in this case, then this energy is always positive. So you can solve that then with fixed boundary condition. Let's say phi is constant at infinity, phi is zero at infinity, let's say. Then that's the unique solution. So I mean, this is essentially the same proof for uniqueness theorem of Laplace equation. This is only slightly general because there is a matrix here, but as long as it's positive definite, it's the same.
Phi is not source for anything?
Because it's...
Phi is not source for anything. If you have any
yes,
source,
but there is no source here. Right, yes.
So you have to insist that it doesn't couple to anything.
Yeah. But the most important thing is that there is no time derivative here. So, I mean, if you source it, then it's going to depend on the source as well. But the thing is, there is no time derivative here. So phi is uniquely fixed by the boundary conditions. And that's, so this is just a side note. But so the claim is that with reasonable boundary conditions, the only possibility, but make this in different color, phi is just a function of the psi. Which means that k, this trace of the extrinsic curvature, is just a function of time for psi in the Hojava time or in the preferred coordinates. So,
reasonable boundary conditions. I mean, in electrostatics, I have intuition for what reasonable boundary conditions are here or not.
So if this is true on your boundary, then it's true everywhere. So, if this is true, this says that k, which is essentially expansion rate, is just a function of time. So in cosmology, you expect that. So if, say, your boundary condition are cosmological boundary conditions, you have some event happening here, but at large distances, you have cosmological. So Hubble constant, just a function of time. And that's the possible reasonable boundary condition. But this is essentially the thing. If this is valid on your boundaries, so, and picture is basically, say you have a spatial boundaries here. So these are your spatial boundaries. So this is time, and this is a space. If you fix phi of t on these boundaries, and make sure that it's just a function of t, and not the direction in which you approach infinity, then that is satisfied. Then that is satisfied everywhere.
Then yes. I agree with on this. But then, as I showed in my talk, now you have to go back to the tensor degrees of freedom and study the Cauchy problem for the whole system, right?
Yes.
So if you fix this Orjava time, as I said, there is only three residual gauge invariants. That means that in this theory, if you go to the tensor degrees of freedom, there is going to be one extra degree of freedom in the tensor. Okay. You can make a complication.
Well, I'm not.
So you have a scalar theory.
Okay. So let me. Okay. So let me write an extra line, and then maybe you can. I can answer you after that. So my point is that if you fix phi of t on the boundaries, then you fix the whole entire solution everywhere. But you can actually see this in different ways. If you just make this assumption that phi is a function of the psi, which is, as I said, is the only consistent possibility with reasonable boundary conditions, then you can just plug things in here and you get S equals integral d4x square root of minus g minus 2 square root of d mu phi, minus phi squared. So this is the action for the scalar piece. And this is actually what we call Kastrupan, and I'm going to talk about that after this. But
this is a completely, I guess you could say this is a non-perturbative Stubelberger, how do you pronounce it? Stueckelberg formalism, because you completely separated the scalar from the tensor degrees of freedom. The tensor degrees of freedom, well, not quite completely. The tensor degrees of freedom sit here. A scalar is just here, and it's coupled to metric only minimally, basically, because g mu nu appears here and here. Sure.
Why? How did you conclude that k is also just a function of psi?
K is phi. Because, you see, what I did here, I just introduced phi as an auxiliary variable.
On the solution of phi.
Yeah. So, and you can actually show it again. If you just start with this action, you can show that the field equation for phi is exactly that. That extrinsic curvature on constant phi surfaces is only a function of phi. And these are also called CMC surfaces, of course, constant mean curvature surfaces. So that's the other terminology that you might have heard. But the statement is that the preferred frame,
which are the constant phi surfaces or constant psi surfaces, are always constant mean curvature surfaces. So that's the geometrical meaning of the preferred frame, at least in the low energy version of Hojava gravity. So your question. Now, here I have a scalar field theory. So you have the Einstein part is the same. I just add a scalar to everything.
No, I haven't fixed anything.
Come on, you choose the Hojava type to do this. You fix time.
No, I haven't. I just to write this equation and fix time. But
of course.
Yeah, but I only did this to draw this conclusion that phi is a function of psi.
If you do it in any other gauge, then you will find this.
No, but if phi is a function of psi, then phi is a function of psi always.
Yes.
So there is no
or change gauge.
There is no, but phi and psi are both physical quantities. So this is exactly the covariant language. I'm using covariant language.
Okay, let's go here. Okay, now, besides this, I have the equations of motion for the metric.
Yeah.
And in this gauge, I kind of fix one polarization of the metric without, otherwise I can fix in general relativity. You can count the degrees of freedom. There is one less residual
gauge.
There's
no gauge choice made.
Yeah.
The equation looks whatever it looks like.
Okay, it looks like this, but then to draw this conclusion, the last line, you have to go to a gauge in which you choose the time, right?
Yeah, but after I draw that conclusion, I come back and
I know, but that's true, that you cannot change gauge as one. Then
why not?
Stick to this gauge. And in this gauge, okay. I solve the rest of the equation.
Sure.
And in this gauge, where you draw this equation's motion, then there's only three residual gauge equations. That means that there will be one extra degree of freedom in the metric.
But there is one extra degree of freedom. But my point is that this is fixed by boundary conditions.
No, it's not in the scalar, it's in the metric. Go on and write the question of motion.
Okay. So I think we should discuss this offline.
If you don't go to that particular gauge, then there is no extra degree of freedom in the metric.
If there is a time derivative, as I showed, there will be a first or let's find derivative.
If you don't pick any case, then the metric there will be no actual decrease, right?
You think I provide
maybe case? Maybe we should have later.
So good. So I made my main point basically. Which I think it's more of a mathematical point, but it's still an interesting point that at least if you want to make sense of a theory, and I mean, there you could do the theory locally without making this. So this is a global constraint, not a local constraint. You see, so locally you wouldn't see this. You have to consider the entire constant field surface with some boundary condition to make this conclusion. But that's that's really the only way to make sense of the theory globally. Locally, you might do other things. And local counting of degrees of freedom is not the same as global counting of degrees of freedom. That's my point here. Now, let me just tell you a little bit. So we thought about this. And I was cosmologist. Kazol is somewhere in the audience. So she was the collaborator in this work. And this is, and I said, we are interested in dark energy models that are scalar tensor theories. But then we hadn't seen anybody talking about that type of theory. So we decided to study what are the properties of it. And so let me just list, so it was a few years ago, and you can find the references in one where I wrote up there. So what are the properties or the cosmological or general phenomenological properties of Pascal time? First of all, it's the name. The name comes from a parasitic plant called dodder, where the Latin name is cascuta, and I guess it's also called love vine, I think, I recently learned. But so it's a parasitic plant in a sense that it doesn't have its own root; it only feeds off whatever it couples to. Which is kind of the same here because this cascutan doesn't have its own dynamical degrees of freedom. It only follows whatever it couples to. So you cannot have a theory of cascutan on its own, or it's going to be a very bizarre theory because it doesn't have any dynamical degree of freedom. And that's of course, the crucial thing, that why it doesn't have dynamical degrees of freedom. Perturbatively, it's easy to make sense of that. But I'm going to make non-perturbative statements about it that might be a little bit less trivial. The first thing you could do is do cosmology. And if I put in, I have to put in the lambda minus one factors, but these are the same lambda minus one factor. It's just lambda minus one factor here. One is that, again, these are constant mean. K is a function of psi. Actually, phi is exactly the extrinsic, mean extrinsic curvature. So the field equation is exactly, for cosmology, is phi. 3H is phi. This is the field equation. We just minimize that action. The density, it turns out for that kind of action, the density of phi is just the potential that appears there. And if you add the 1 minus lambda factors, it's just 9 times 1 minus lambda divided by 16 pi gn, pi squared, or sorry, h squared. Now, potentially, density is a function of phi, but phi is just proportional to h. So density of phi goes as h squared. And then it's not surprising that this just renormalizes your Friedmann equation, because your Friedmann equation is h squared equals 8 pi gn over 3 times rho matter plus rho phi. But rho phi is proportional to h squared. So at the level of cosmology or homogeneous cosmology, this just renormalizes your Friedmann equation. However, it normalizes the G that appears here. That's exactly the effect that Paul mentioned, that G cosmology is slightly different from G Newton because of these 1 minus lambda factors. On a smaller scale, however, you can actually calculate the speed of sound for that theory, and that's a standard thing that cosmology people who have studied dark energy, for example, do. They construct field theories with different sound speeds. For that particular action, though, what you exactly find is that CS squared is infinite, which means that the field equation only have a spatial derivative, no time derivative, which is exactly what you have here, basically. There is no time derivative here. And this means that this quote-unquote dark energy doesn't cluster on a smaller scale because it has huge speed of sound. It is incompressible, as I promised earlier. So on a smaller scale, nothing changes. It's only on super horizon scales where you have this normalization. And you might be interested to actually see how this looks like. So this is what we call a running of tank mass. So the ratio of a Planck mass squared defined from Einstein's equation divided by Planck mass in the UV, 10 minutes, thank you, is just 1 plus 3 halves lambda minus 1, 1 plus k squared divided by 3h squared to the minus 1, and 1 plus, or 1 minus k squared. So you can exactly see how this depends on k. On the smaller scales, when k is much bigger than h, this term goes to 0. A long wavelength, when k is 0, then you have a slightly different Planck mass. And it's actually interesting because this is very... So first was from here. Did you follow this? My rho phi is slightly depends on h squared. So the G Newton, the effective G that appears here is slightly denormalized. But on a smaller scales, it's not denormalized. And to get it exactly, you just have to solve the field equation for linear perturbations, basically, and find delta rho phi for linear perturbations. So this is basically where it comes from. So this is defined to be... the ratio of delta G00 as a function of K divided by delta rho matter as a function of K. So in your Poisson equation, so this would be zero. This would be just Newton's constant because G00 or delta G00 proportional to delta rho matter. But then because you have this extra component, that's going to change this from being 1, being Planck mass. And I think I should probably add the Planck mass somewhere here. Maybe this is the inverse of this. So.
By just looking at one component of the Einstein tensor, you can identify something you should call the renormalized Planck mass.
This is a sloppy notation. So this is exactly what it means. It's just the ratio of one component. The other components wouldn't care about this. If you do it with other components, you would get something different. So, yeah. But the main point in the limits is actually an exact statement. The transition exactly wouldn't look like this in different gauges. But in the limits, on a smaller scale, because this dark energy, or quote unquote dark energy, doesn't cluster, you don't have any effect. On larger scales, it just exactly scales as h squared, so it denormalizes your Planck mass. And that statement exactly is independent of gauge. But the k dependence can change. So, I don't have much time. Let's see. I think the coolest thing about Kaskutan, which actually shed light on a lot of these bizarre properties, is the fact that it's really not a coupled theory. This phi. There is, in an exact sense, it has not dynamics. Now, you've seen it here, really. But in a covariant theory, saying that something only depends on a space and doesn't depend on time, in a covariant theory, that doesn't make sense. So I don't think anybody has really formulated what non-dynamical means in a covariant theory. And I want to argue for you that this is exactly what a non-dynamical theory is. Just the scalar part is exactly what a non-dynamical theory looks like if it's covariant. And the way you can show this is if you just look at that action, e for x, square root of minus g, d mu phi, plus 5 squared, Now, this is a general action. Now, let me fix the time coordinate or the foliation so that phi is just a function of t. Now, I can always pick a foliation. This is covariant. So then this becomes integral dt, d to the x, square root of minus g3. This is, or the, I guess it doesn't have a minus anymore. So this is just a 3-metric phi dot plus 1/2 of integral d4x. This is the regular g, the 4g phi square. Now, you see, there is an interesting property here. This is just integral d phi, dt phi dot, and that's just the reflection of the fact that this kinetic term is not really a kinetic term. You just have integral d phi, sigma phi here, where sigma is the tree volume of constant phi hypersurfaces. This is the first term. Now, the second term, you can do an integration by parts and show that this is just integral of v of phi, where v is the 4 volume of constant phi hypersurfaces. So that means that if you have a constant phi hypersurface, sigma is on the surface, and v is everywhere inside. Now, this is just this was d volume times phi squared, or d4 volume times phi squared. I do an integration for I phi, it becomes v times d phi. So this is, there is a phi here, by the way. Phi. So just to make it clear, this thing is dv, d4 volume. And then I do an integration by parts. This becomes v, d phi. So there is nothing that couples different constant phi surfaces in this theory. So the action is just the sum of terms that are only geometric functionals of constant phi surfaces. But there is nothing in the action that couples different constant phi surfaces. So this is the definition of a non-dynamical theory. Non-dynamical covariant theory. So phi does actually can depend on time and space, but since there's nothing that couples different constant phi surfaces to each other, then here in that picture that I had up there, if I change this constant phi surface, this guy doesn't care. If I change this one, this guy. If I fix the boundary condition, fix the endpoints of these surfaces, then that fixes the surfaces completely. And that is the statement that I made earlier, that the boundary condition fixes all the dynamical degrees of freedom of phi. And I guess it's also interesting to notice that these are exactly the same as soap bubbles. Because soap bubbles have a surface term, a surface tension, and have a volume term, which is proportional to the volume difference between the two sides, or actually pressure difference between the two sides times their volume. And it's not, you wouldn't be surprised then that soap bubbles are actually constant mean curvature surfaces. So this theory, so the statement of non-dynamic, well, okay, so I've made connections between Ojava-Lipschitz gravity, soap bubbles, and I guess Einstein ether, or some type of Einstein ether. I'm not sure, but did I mention something else? Yeah. An incompressible gravitational ether. But so they're all the same thing, really. at least the scalar part of it. The scalar part. Yeah, so the rest are more interesting, of course. Sure.
So when you wrote down your initial action, right, and when you did your analysis, you throw away the high curvature terms, right?
I did.
All the potential terms.
Yes, exactly.
And you call this the infrared limit of Ravanovich's gravity.
But except for, not all the potential. I kept the Ricci curvature, which is, I kept the GR part of it.
Right, but how do you, I mean, you call this the infrared limit, right, of Ravanovich's, how do you know after some renormalization group calculation or whatsoever, that would be, you know, the one term you should keep, the one Lorentz symmetry breaking that you
Well, so the only term that I did ignore was that grad n term at low energies that Diego was mentioning. So there could be grad n squared terms. But if for some reason I say, I have some reason to say that those terms aren't there, then this is the only thing that's left at low energies. What else is there at low energies?
But you need to see how, I don't know, I'm not an expert in normalization group triangulation, but don't you need to see how the couplings run and what's happening in this thing?
That's the only, so it's this and then grad n squared, basically. So if that's a two, and I'm ignoring grad n squared, but I actually think that there might be a good reason for ignoring that grad n squared that Paul has. And that's maybe that up here. That there might be something deep into this decoupling that, or the dynamic nature that makes everything work. So this theory doesn't have any trouble with GR. It's exactly GR at low energies.
Everybody.
You do not agree with that. But this is exactly, but as soon as you start introducing new degrees of freedom, oh, thank you, 0 minutes, then that may not be the case anymore. So I guess now I have zero minutes. That really means 5 minutes, right?
Well, anyway, I'm not sure if I can get into much more details. But I basically told you what Kaskutan is. The actual limit on lambda minus one that comes from cosmology, and it's basically a combination of CMB and Lyman alpha forest, is that lambda minus one is less than 1% basically at 95% level. And this is much stronger than the Big Bang nucleosynthesis constraint. And it's essentially because when you introduce a mismatch between Friedmann equation and Newton's law, then that actually shows up in cosmology, in a growth of structures in cosmology. The thing that I didn't get to, and I was very excited about, is how if you put this model around black holes, you can actually solve the dark energy problem. But then I guess 5 minutes isn't enough to explain that. So I guess I'm going to end here. Thank you.
Like to mention, so because if you do the analysis right, you take the full forever, some forever Lipschitz kind theory, and even if you set this kinetic Lorentz symmetry breaking term to zero, you still get scalar mode, right? So if you say now the origin of the scalar mode is intrinsic, you know, it's from this kinetic Lorentz symmetry breaking term only, that is not true. So if you really have some other terms, I'm not sure exactly which terms or what, but you could also, there's also, you know, the nature of the scalar mode is not just in the kinetic term. I just want to say that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if there are other terms, I mean, what I showed here was if you just have this term, then this is what you get. If you have other terms, then you have to redo this and see what you get. And I guess, as Diego argued, if you add grad n squared, you actually make this dynamical. So this would be more similar to a scalar tensor theory. But the thing is, at low energies, you don't have that many options. So I'm not sure. If you can tell me what else you expect there to be, then I can tell you what. But I mean, the scalar tensor theory, you basically are quantified by the speed of sound and their background evolution. And in this particular case, having only this tells you the speed of sound is infinite. If you add an extra term, then the speed of sound may not be infinite. But I don't think there would be much more difference.
If you put lambda to 1,
yes,
then it's true that this new degree of freedom may be light and will come from the other things. The thing is that we're...
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. So then...
It's not the same thing.
But you see, the thing is, perturbation theory, and this is a point I have to maybe make earlier, perturbation theory is very, very tricky here, because, so this is what you wind up with. You're on fire. so, And you might remember this from degenerate perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. So the thing is that if you have a degenerate Hamiltonian, which has basically degenerate eigenspace, it has a symmetry, and then you introduce a small perturbation that breaks the symmetry, then it's not as easy to do perturbation theory. You cannot do it around any background. You should do it in a particular background. And I forgot the point.
Higher than you.
So exactly. So it makes a very big difference what type of term you use. For example, if it's projectable or non-projectable, it makes the world difference. Basically, the non-projectable version prefers constant mean curvature surfaces. The projectable version basically prefers normals to geodesics, as Shinji will argue. And any other term that you introduce, if this term isn't there, it's going to be completely different. So it's actually very tricky to do this perturbation theory when you're breaking a symmetry. And you may expect non-trivial behaviors or a strong coupling, especially if you perturb around the wrong background. And yeah, I think I agree with you.
Sure. Particular question, and here you throw away these higher curvature segment. If you leave them, they will appear as some type of energy density on the right hand side.
Yes.
Therefore, the conclusion then is purely psi dependent.
That's going to be broken, yes.
That's going to be broken. And so here you make the analysis by first throwing them away and then seeing. But a priori.
But.
They play a strong role in fact.
So my answer is that here is your soap bubble. So if you ignore those terms, then you have a prescription for fixing these surfaces, and that's by minimizing the action of this soap bubble, or the energy of this soap bubble. Now, if you add higher curvature terms, then your soap bubble isn't as simple as it used to be. So you may have, in addition to surface term and volume terms, you might have higher curvature terms in your soap bubble. But it's not that your soap bubble is going to be radically different. It's just, so it's not the mean curvature, but it's some other curvature. That's not exactly CM constant. It's not K, but it's some other curvature that will be constant.
So the decoupling will not longer be true. The decoupling will be different species.
Well, that's true. If this decoupling, and I'm thinking that there might be something deep about this decoupling, that maybe that might be guidance for UV completing the theory if you manage to keep the decoupling. Because the decoupling seems to be there at low energies if you force the extra degrees of freedom to be absent. So maybe the way to make this natural is to make the coupling true at all energies. And all you do is keep that form of the action the same, just add higher curvature. In addition to 3-volume and 4-volume, add curvature terms into that. And I guess the example that you made is kind of like, well, I'm not sure the example. The term be that R3, I should think about that. But that's a possibility. So maybe that's a way to UV complete the theory. But yeah, in general, decoupling may not hold. So some things may break down. But at least it does seem to hold at low energies for the Ojala lifted.
From the covariant way you work, and from this reparametrization invariance, you can prove that you always have this kind of equation.
Yes.
I mean that in this gauge that you choose, this is always non-dynamic.
Even if you have higher curvature terms.
Yes.
Yeah, I see.
But it is a positive metric.
So, but here's a question: is this?
It's not being positive.
NIJ, you mean?
Yeah. But at low energies, it would be positive, if it's positive at low, without those terms.
Yeah.
But here's a question though that I guess we need to address at some point. In the non-projectable case, when you add the higher curvature term, do the constraints propagate? Is this a consistent theory or not? And I'm not sure. I'd like to hear because I think I've heard both accounts. I haven't really those higher curvature terms are really nasty to deal with. But does everybody believe that the theory is inconsistent with the higher curvature terms? Do you agree?
I see the same. The theory is the same.
The theory is the same. You don't think there is any problem. So you think, okay, so you think that, because the constraints do propagate in this case, because I mean there is nothing wrong with if K is a function of psi, there is no pathology. The only pathologies come in when you make K not constant. If K is constant, then it's not dynamical. If there's no strong, yes.
I have a question about the constraint.
Yes.
I remember at some point, say in the past, you were talking about defining the Newton constant by a factor of 4/3. Or
yeah.
Is that that? Like, because
no, no, no. So there are two things. There is a scale dependence, which is not good. This is the constraint. This is the constraint. But then there is a dependence on the equation of a state. And they are very different. They are completely different. That's the thing that I was very excited about, but didn't get to talk about. But the fourthness is there, alive and kicking.
So, from what I understand at this conference, people claim that there's a pathological strong fucking mode.
Yes. And I say it's not really dynamical, so it might even.
So if I maybe I misunderstand what you're saying. So, you're using a scalar field which doesn't couple to anything.
Yes.
So therefore you don't get into trouble with the strong.
But there's strong coupling that Diego was claiming with coupling with metric. So it does couple to metric. And that the claim is that becomes a strongly coupled.
The claim is that in this gate the strong coupling is in the tensor modes.
In the tensor modes. Mm-hmm. They're saying the tensor modes are strong are well, I mean that because see, this is just dark energy. I mean, it's the same reason that quintessence and dark energy that people talk about doesn't couple to tensor mode. This is just dark energy, but even less faster than dark energy is. So I mean, you can just physically, I don't understand what could go wrong. Mathematically, I'm not sure, but physically, I think this is this incompressible fluid. And then there you have tensor mode gravity waves passing through it. And I don't see what could go wrong there.
Well, how would you detect this field?
Well, through its effect on other things. Not directly. I mean, I don't know. If it has direct couplings, you can detect it. Maybe it couples to photons and gives you an energy-dependent speed of light, something like that. So maybe this is just an ether, so you could have all these preferred frame effects in principle. But yeah, I mean, I understand that those are very much constrained, so you have to make the coupling small enough.
You're hiding things by doing this non-dynamical thing. It's a funny schizophrenic way to do physics.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm quite used to it by now, but.
So maybe you. Okay.
I just want to make a point which I already mentioned yesterday that this might sound like an exotic scenario where you kill off the scalar field local propagation by some funny boundary condition global effects. And one can ask whether we have a precedent for this. And there is a beautiful precedent where exactly that mechanism works, and that's three-dimensional topological elastic gravity, where if you don't impose fancy boundary conditions to kill off the extra scalar mode, you get a theory which seems to propagate a scalar, but doesn't seem to work at the level of operating set partition function, since the generic boundary conditions do lead to wrong predictions for the whole CFT. If you impose boundary conditions, which people like call chiral gravity now, that basically globally kills off completely the scalar degree of freedom, and you end up with zero propagating increase of freedom, you calculate a partition function, and it seems to satisfy the axioms of the dual CFT. So that's exactly the same type of mechanism. You have a local analysis that tells you that you might have a propagating thing, but the correct boundary conditions that define the quantum gravity theory for you actually eliminate that degree of freedom completely. I don't know whether this is perfect.
But it's definitely very similar.
It's exactly the same logic.
Yeah. I mean, the math is simple. So, I mean, it's essentially what I wrote on the board. So, but the quantization question is, of course, you have to. I haven't answered the quantization and normalizability really, so that's still there.
There's still the question whether it survives non-perturbability. The metric becomes, by doing higher curvature term and a very high curve space time, the metric becomes negative definite, then you might look for a very different type of background.
Sure. But I think at low energies, that I don't see why that's.
Because then you could lower the energy by. by just going to this very curved space.
But the issue of identifying the current vacuum, that's one of the central issues.
Yeah.
But maybe this image is the key. Okay. Well,
I have a small announcement. It's just a change of schedule for tomorrow afternoon. No.